que sofrer e tem que chorar e tem que querer pra poder amar. Ah, mundo enganador, paz não quer mais dizer amor. Ah, não existe coisa mais triste que ter paz e se arrepender. Se proteger de um amor a mais.
Fade down, Herbie Hancock and Show. And WRT 89.9 FM, Madison. BBC News coming up next.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. No aid trucks have entered northern Gaza since an Israeli strike killed seven aid workers on Monday. A video from the Kuwait roundabout in Gaza City, where large numbers of people would normally be waiting for aid deliveries, shows next to nobody. Residents say the price of flour has doubled in recent days. Asma Al-Najjar is a local resident.
People are just broken now. Those who had money when they were displaced have nothing left now. Prices in the market are like the prices for tourists, if not worse. We are facing a parallel war launched by the merchants. We have nothing left to make ends meet. There's a war against us, and even our own merchants are turning against us.
White House sources say the planned phone conversation between President Biden and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has now taken place. It's their first known contact since Israel launched an attack that killed seven aid workers in Gaza. The NATO Secretary General says the military alliance is not and will not be a party to the conflict in Ukraine. Jens Stoltenberg was speaking at an event marking NATO's 75th anniversary.
We don't have any plans of having any NATO combat troops inside Ukraine. There have been no requests for that. Ukraine is defending their land, defending their territory, and we have the right to support Ukraine in defending themselves, and that's what NATO allies are doing.
A NATO official has said Russia does not appear to be able to launch a significant offensive this spring. He added that Ukrainian strikes on Russian refineries may have disrupted more than 15% of their capacity. A military-run television station in Myanmar says 13 drones were shot down on Thursday over the capital, Naypyidaw, in what it describes as an attack by terrorists. The report said four were carrying explosives, but there were no casualties or damage. The National Unity Government, which represents the elected administration overthrown in a coup, called the attack a success. Here's Jonathan Head.
The military has acknowledged shooting down at least seven drones. They've had to shut the airport briefly because one of their drones managed to launch a bomb which landed quite close to a runway. And there's no indication yet that there was any significant damage. It's hard for us to confirm because there's no independent witnesses there. We're only taking what the military is telling us. But we know these drones can't carry very heavy bombs and they can only really carry a few kilos. So it's unlikely there's been any significant damage. This is really all about symbolism.
Congress in Peru has voted against opening impeachment proceedings against President Dina Boluarte, who's been being investigated for corruption. The opposition was only able to muster 32 of the 48 votes it needed. Last week, police raided Ms. Boluarte's home and the presidential palace. World News from the BBC. A judge in the US state of Georgia has rejected an attempt by Donald Trump to have criminal charges in the state's 2020 election interference case against him dismissed. The former president had argued these violated his rights to free speech. The sprawling indictment charges Mr. Trump and more than a dozen other defendants with violating an act normally associated with mobsters to accuse them of a criminal enterprise to keep him in power after he lost the election to Joe Biden. President Emmanuel Macron has said France and its allies could have stopped the genocide in Rwanda in 1994, but did not have the will to halt the slaughter. His comments come in a message to be published on the 30th anniversary of the start of the killings on Sunday. The UN mission in Rwanda had been warning of the risks of violence ahead of the shooting, but these were ignored. President Macron has said he is convinced that Russia is using disinformation to target the upcoming Olympic Games in Paris. He was speaking to reporters at the inauguration of a swimming centre for the Games.
I have no doubt that this is happening, including in terms of information. Every day, Russia is spreading the idea that we can't do this or that, that there will be risks, and that's why we have to stand firm. Strength, self-confidence, and respect for the truth are the strengths of democracies and great nations.
The Kremlin is indignant that because of its war against Ukraine, its athletes and those of Belarus will only be allowed to take part as neutrals and not under their national flags. Three of the world's top competitive cyclists have been involved in a serious crash on the fourth stage of the Tour of the Basque Country. They include the current Tour de France champion, the Danish rider Jonas Vingegaard, who was evacuated from the scene on a stretcher. He is currently being examined in hospital. That's the latest BBC World News.
Merry Contest is Sunday, April 7th at the beautiful Garver Feed Mill to benefit Great Lakes Hemophilia Foundation and the Bleeding Disorders Community of Wisconsin. Local bars and restaurants give back by showcasing their signature Bloody Mary Bix and garnish, and you get to be the judge. You can vote for your favorite in a number of different categories, including most inventive, most like Milwaukee, most like a meal, and best overall. Tickets include an appetizer buffet and beer chasers. Tickets and more information are available at glhf.org/events. Great Lakes Hemophilia Foundation is celebrating 50 years of educating, supporting, and advocating for treatment of bleeding disorders in Wisconsin. The fourth annual Best Bloody Mary Contest to support Great Lakes Hemophilia Foundation is at the Garver Feed Mill on Sunday, April 7th, starting at 10:30 a.m. You are listening to WORT Madison.
Six foot six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war.
And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. During the 1960s and early 70s, as the U.S. war on Southeast Asia escalated, an anti-war movement emerged that arguably altered the course of history. That movement didn't take place on college campuses, but in barracks and on aircraft carriers. It flourished in army stockades, navy brigs, and in small towns across the country around military bases. Most significantly, it spread to Vietnam itself, where rank-and-file resistance eventually came to have a direct impact on the U.S. capacity to prosecute the war. In advance of a special April 10th Madison screening of Sir, No Sir, the remarkable documentary chronicle of anti-war resistance within the military during the Vietnam War, today's special guest is the film's director and writer, David Zeiger. David Zeiger, welcome to WORT.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, let's jump right in. You know, Dave, Sir, No Sir traces the evolution of the anti-war movement within the military, not just in terms of numbers, but in regard to tactics as service people moved from protest to resistance to defiance and on occasion to open rebellion. Let's talk about some background for this film. That is, talk about the origins of Sir, No Sir. What did you set out to do?
Well, actually, the origins of Sir, No Sir, I could argue, is from when I was a teenager, late teenager, during the Vietnam War. And as I turned more and more against the war, I started looking around for what could I do, what could I be part of that would have the most impact. And I met a couple people who were the staff members of a place called the Oleo Strut, which was what was called a GI coffee house that was outside Fort Hood, Texas, in Killeen, Texas. The coffee houses were initiated by SDS, Students for Democratic Society, some people in that organization, wanted to go and support what they were hearing about, which was the beginning resistance of soldiers against the war. So I ended up spending 2 years in Killeen, Texas, at the Oleostrut, on the civilian staff of that. And in the course of that, that was kind of the situation in the military went from a lot of kind of underground resistance to the war. There were some underground newspapers that were being put out by active duty GIs to open rebellion and open resistance, which really flourished in the early 1970-71. I was there for one of the largest anti-war demonstrations of active duty soldiers during the war, which was what was officially Armed Forces Day, but the GIs referred to it as Armed Forces Day. And over about 1,500 active duty GIs marched against the war right outside the right outside the gates of Fort Hood. So the defiance really got very, very open. I was initially, when I started making, I didn't start making films until the 90s, the early 90s. And of course, I knew this story very well from having, you know, lived with it and part of it. But I simply could not get any interest. No one was interested in, you know, it was old news, you know, the Vietnam War, you know, the veterans were all, you know, beginning to get to age. And what changed all of that was when the United States invaded Iraq. And the issue of American service people, you know, Marines, soldiers, sailors, opposing an American imperial war, became something that suddenly there was a lot of interest in that. And I was, you know, it was in that context, it was in the context of the Iraq War, that I was able to get the, you know, both the financing and the general interest in this story to be able to tell it and bring it back out into the open. And this is after about 30, 40 years, in which the story of the American GIs opposing the war was very deeply buried under the mythology of an anti-war movement that hated soldiers, that spat on them when they came home, and that this was a myth that had been created by the right wing in kind of summing up the war in the 1970s and 80s, and really kind of took off in the 90s and became essentially, you know, accepted as the actual story of the relationship between the Vietnam anti-war movement and the soldiers. And, you know, I really set out to correct the historic record. And I think it's an extremely important correction because it completely changes people's understanding of what happened in the 60s. And you can extend that to the present day. So, excuse me, I'm sorry, I have a little bit of a cold, so I'm a little bit hoarse. But that's kind of the general background of the film.
You know, you made me recall this. I was listening to you that when I first saw Sir, No Sir, when it came out, if memory serves me well, it was brought to Madison. The first showing of it was by the then Iraq Veterans Against the War, the British. In the area here, so the connection was well made. David Zeiger, the film begins with the stories of several individual acts of conscience, of personal protests by what were described as a few malcontents. We're talking 1965 through 67. Talk about that a little bit. Talk about Donald Duncan and Howard Levy.
Yeah, I think those are both tremendous stories. I mean, Donald Duncan was a Green Beret. He was what was called a lifer. He was a lifetime member of the military, the Green Berets. And as he says in the film, he loved it. He thought he was doing the right thing. He thought he was protecting America. And but his direct experience in Vietnam this is in the early stages of the war when the United States was supposedly taking, you know, just an advisory role for the South Vietnamese military. And part of that advising included torture and kind of widespread killings of civilians. And Donald, you know, over a brief period of time, realized that this was just the opposite of what he had signed up for. And he refused. He refused to be, I think after returning from Vietnam, he refused to go back, and he actually officially resigned from the military, and he became a very vocal opponent of the war. Really one of the first active duty soldiers who joined up with the anti-war movement and became somewhat of a celebrity because of his status. I think New York Times.
Ramparts.
Ramparts, that's right. Yeah, I had a feature article about him. And around the similar time, Howard Levy, who was a doctor, who had been drafted in the military because the military at that time drafted everyone. Howard was a dermatologist, and he was stationed in the U.S., but his job, his assignment was to train Green Beret soldiers in some basic dermatology. It sounds like a very kind of innocuous kind of thing. But what he learned was that what was happening was that the Green Berets were using this very kind of basic knowledge of essentially how to get rid of a skin infection in order to win the hearts and minds of the people. This was part of the strategy of the United States, was to win the hearts and minds of the villagers, the people of South Vietnam. But at the same time, as Howard talks about, they were bombing villages, destroying, driving people out, and that this was what he was actually part of, was a subterfuge. It was something to a kind of a dishonest way of creating loyalty among the South Vietnamese people. And he also then refused. He literally threw the Green Beret out of his office. And this became a very public refusal because the military went after him in a big way. They wanted to put him away for 20 years. And his trial, his conviction, his whole story became a very big touchstone of this beginning anti-war movement inside the military and outside. It served to build a lot of support among civilian anti-war activists, who, by the way, just to make the point, you know, knew very well all along that there was a good deal of support among soldiers for the anti-war movement and were very supportive of that. And there was a lot of unity in the course of the war between those two sides of the anti-war movement.
Watching the film again, I picked up on things that I hadn't picked up on before. When was this first public refusal of orders to go to Vietnam, the Fort Hood 3? Talk about that for a minute.
The Fort Hood 3, yes, I think they were in 1964. And these were three guys who had been part of the civil rights movement, who had been drafted, and were kind of the early examples of particularly African-American soldiers recognizing that there was definitely a convergence of their struggle in this country with the struggle of the Vietnamese for their independence. It didn't take a lot to understand that what had happened in Vietnam was that there had been an independent free election that elected Ho Chi Minh, who had been a leader of the resistance against the French colonialists, and the United States, you know, essentially in created the situation in which there were now two countries, South and North Vietnam, in order to defeat Ho Chi Minh and the much more progressive communist progressive forces that he represented. And, you know, I think the 4-3 were significant in that they saw that, you know, that connection between their struggle, and particularly in terms of race, in terms of the fact that the Vietnamese were, you know, a race of people that were being, you know, very, you know, increasingly viciously attacked by the American military. And they, you know, despite the fact that they were in the military, they'd been drafted, they knew they would refuse to go to Vietnam. And so, again, their case, the case of the 4-3, I think they were in prison for about 5 years. They became a very, a spark, essentially, that spread very quickly, particularly among African-American GIs in the military.
The movement, as the war escalates, so does the movement. The movement in the period we're talking about, the mid-60s, late-60s, moves from this stage of personal protest to collective resistance. The second phase really took shape during 1968-69, as Lyndon Johnson and then Richard Nixon escalated the war. The anti-war movement within the military followed suit. Talk about 1968 as a turning point.
1968, that was kind of a turning point for everyone. The most, inside Vietnam, probably the most well-known event that happened in 68 was called the Tet Offensive, in which the North Vietnamese and North Vietnamese Army and the National Liberation Front, which were the South Vietnamese guerrilla soldiers.
We're getting the sirens here.
I
hope they're not coming for you.
No, not yet. Actually, I'm in New York. A lot of sirens in New York. Anyway, so what happened is that the North Vietnamese and the National Liberation Front launched an offensive which initially actually literally overran the entire country of South Vietnam and the South Vietnamese military, and pretty much demonstrated to the world that this was a war that America had created and imposed, and that was, you know, that was very much against the entire population of Vietnam, and that, you know, and also a war that the United States would, you know, was not going to be capable of winning, exactly because of that. And I think there were two things about that, both, you know, it both exposing how this war was a popular resistance among the people of Vietnam against the United States, and that the United States was really, had no, you know, no ability to win this war without slaughtering millions of people, which eventually it did, despite the fact that the U.S. did not win the war. And that kind of, that emboldened, and I think in a big way initiated, a much broader movement inside the military against the war, which, you know, I mentioned underground newspapers. There had been, you know, in 1965, 66, you know, a few underground newspapers started by soldiers, literally, you know, using mimeograph machines or anything at their disposal. And by 1968, that had ballooned ultimately there were over 300 different newspapers, underground newspapers that were put out by GIs themselves at Fort Hood, where the Oleo Strut was opened in 1968. They had, you know, access to printing, you know, a printing press, and one GI, Gypsy Peterson, was able to put together this newspaper and start distributing it, and it really, you know, blossomed in a very big way. It became a very big part of how soldiers expressed their opposition to the war and organized against it. And inside Vietnam, in the wake of the Tet Offensive, there were a number of incidents in which GIs began refusing to go out into the field, refusing to go on combat missions, initially sometimes as individuals, but that became something where eventually entire companies were refusing to go out. The military prison, the army prison in Vietnam, which was called Long Binh Jail and was renamed by the prisoners, it was LBJ, which are the initials of Lyndon Johnson. It was a massive uprising of, again, in this situation, just like in the U.S., something like 60 or 70% of the prisoners were African American, and these were GIs who either refused to go out into the field or in some way were opposing or resisting the military and the war. There was a rebellion in Long Binh Jail. They literally burned the entire jail down before the army was able to quell that.
You're listening to Dave Zeiger, the writer and director of the documentary film Sir, No Sir, recounting the anti-war movement during the Vietnam era of people in the military. I'll open up the phone lines at half past the hour in a few minutes, excuse me, at 608-256-2001 if you want to join with a question, a comment, an observation for our guest today, David Zeiger. Again, 608-256-2001. David Zeiger is going to be in town. There's going to be a showing of Sir, No Sir on April 10th at 7 o'clock at the State Historical Society of Wisconsin on the Library Mall across from the Memorial Union. It's part of a larger program of events under the rubric Waging Peace in Vietnam, U.S. Soldiers and Veterans Who Opposed the War. There's exhibits and programs, speakers, and a number of films. Again, Dave Zeiger's Sir, No Sir will be showing Wednesday, April 10th at 7 p.m. at the Wisconsin Historical Society on the Library Mall. You know, you mentioned the underground newspapers. I hadn't thought about it before until this, you know, this, watching the film again, but that there was this general term for alternative press during the times that proliferated in civilian society, in the military, and so on, that there were underground press. But within the military, it certainly had to have a clandestine underground structure to it, because they were contraband. So I never thought about that before.
Yeah, I mean,
I want to... You mentioned in passing earlier on the significance of the anti-war coffee houses that also proliferated around U.S. bases across the country, that they came to have this like subversive role as troops returning from Vietnam and those being sent intermingled. Talk about that as the underground. Anti-war coffee houses as subversive institutions.
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, the coffee houses were really played a tremendous role, in particular, you know, in creating a situation where civilians and soldiers could meet and talk about the war and plan. For actions, and also it was like the Oleo Strut where I was. We had a bookstore, we had a legal counseling office. I mean, soldiers could come in, you know, and get all of the underground newspapers from around the country. Could get anti-war and radical literature, and in particular, and this was an important thing, was it that you know. At that time, one of the things that the military did. Was, you know, if you were drafted, you were in for 2 years, and if you enlisted, you were in for three.
Thank you, man.
And the tour of duty in Vietnam was 6 months to a year. So what would happen was, you know, for example, if you were drafted, you went in, you did your training, you went to Vietnam, and then you came back, and you still had 6 months left to serve, even though you weren't going to be going back to Vietnam. And the Army really, actually, what one of the things that the Army did with these folks who came back was that they trained them in riot control duty to be used in the streets of America. But what happened at Fort Hood in particular, as an example, was that you had the same guy, the guys who had just come back from Vietnam and the guys who were about to be sent there in the same, on the same base. And there was a lot of communication and a lot of, as Dave Klein, one of the people who was very active in the movement, said, that the guys who had been to Vietnam played a subversive roles with the people who were going to be going. So you had this kind of explosive growth, you know, even among, not just among, both among soldiers who had been there, but also among soldiers who were facing being sent to Vietnam for a year, as the movement kind of emerged and took more shape, became much more part of the dynamic of what was going on.
Again, you're listening to Dave Zeiger, the writer and director of the significant, very important documentary on the GI anti-war movement during the Vietnam era, Sir, No Sir. Our phone lines are open at 608-256-2001. Jade tells me that we do have a caller with the question. Hey, Elliot, you're on the air.
Hey, hello, Al. Great documentary, certainly one of my favorites. I was struck after listening to it a couple of times about the rap and spoken word tapes that are used in the documentary. And in my cursory attempt to find more of these recordings, I really haven't been able to find any source or any recordings. And I'm wondering if your guest could give me a little pointer on that. It's such great and unique music.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Let me think. Are you one of the things you're probably referring to is the song that's kind of the theme at the end of the film by Boots Riley and the Coup, called Captain Sterling's Little Problem? Or is there other stuff that you're talking about?
Well, I thought I heard it a couple of times, maybe more in the background. I really need to listen to it again, I guess. But did you say Boots Riley?
Yeah. Boots Riley, the current filmmaker, his band is called The Coup, C-O-U-P.
Okay.
They wrote songs for several of my films, but Boots wrote this one in particular, which is just a great song for the film. And I think we did use it, you know, at different points in the course of it. But it's called Captain Sterling's Little Problem, and it's by The Coup, Boots Riley and The Coup.
And was this actually a cultural thing within Vietnam at the time, or is this something that was outside of that?
Well, I mean, Boots is more of a contemporary musician and writer. Similar music that was popular, in the country as a whole, you know, was very popular among the GIs. And, the song by the Animals, "We Got to Get Out of This Place," was actually one of the most popular songs in Vietnam for obvious reasons. I'd have to think about.
Thank you, Elliot.
I hope that helps.
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Dave Zeiger, I'm going to stick with 1968, that seminal year. Talk about the Presidio 27 and what that meant.
Yeah, excuse me. The Presidio 27 has a very particular impact on things. I mean, for one thing, you know, again, one of the things that you know, just individual types of resistance that went on was people going AWOL, absent without leave. Actually, at one point, the military, I think, chronicled something like 500,000 total instances of soldiers going AWOL or deserting completely. And the Presidio was full. The Presidio was the military base at San Francisco, right on the bay. And the Presidio stockade was filled with both black and white GIs who either all the way from people who just on a personal level, you know, decided there was no way they were going to go to Vietnam, to people who had taken a political stand against the war. There was something that preceded that, which was called the Nine for Peace, which was a group of soldiers from every branch of the military who got together and who took sanctuary in a church, refused, very publicly refused to go to Vietnam, and were given a tremendous amount of support by the anti-war movement in the Bay Area. They were in the San Francisco Bay Area. And they ended up in the Presidio, and they, of course, connected with other soldiers there. And what happened in the Presidio stockade was there was one guy who was very mentally unstable, and who one day told a guard, "I think I'm just going to walk out of here." And he started walking away from the guard, and the guard shot him in the back and killed him. And that sparked a huge outrage inside the stockade, which eventually developed into a plan to do a sit-down strike, simply a sit-down strike to against doing any of the work in the stockade. It didn't even necessarily have a very overt anti-Vietnam War aspect to it. It was objecting to the very oppressive conditions inside the military that were exemplified by this guy getting killed. And when they were arrested, the military was so worried about what was going on in the military that they charged these guys with mutiny for simply sitting down and refusing to work. Mutiny is a capital offense in the military. And these guys were facing the death sentence for that. And as word got out in San Francisco and in the anti-war movement generally, there a huge support movement grew up in San Francisco behind the Presidio, what they were called the Presidio Mutineers. And it did force the military to back off on the mutiny charge, but all of them ended up getting sentences of up to 2-3 years in prison for this one act of resistance. The Presidio 27 became one of the groups of soldiers that the word spread all throughout the military and sparked a lot of opposition, a lot of support.
I'm happy to see that the phone lines are lighting up, lots of people taking interest in this program today. Let's go back to the lines for a minute. Hey, Scott, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. I'd like to thank Mr. Zeiger for making this very important film. And I'd like to know from his viewpoint, in the nearly 10 years since the film came out, what are some of the things that surprised him most about reactions to or impacts of the release of this film? Thank you.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Scott. It's really, here's the interesting thing about this, and what is unfortunately continues to be surprising, is how this is such a brand new reality for so many people. And I think this is partly, you know, the impetus for the exhibit that's being shown there as well. The reality of the anti-war movement in the military has been so deeply suppressed in American history that not only do young people not know about it, but the memories of people, even people who were around at the time, have been reshaped. And, you know, we haven't talked about it yet, but one of the big issues that I go into in the film is the myth of, I call it the myth of the spitting hippie, the myth of GIs being spat on when they returned from Vietnam. One of the impetus for the making the film was Jerry Lemke's book, The Spitting Image, in which Jerry, who is a sociologist and a vet, had done this massive research study to try to find out if there's any reality to that myth, and discovered that there simply is none. There, you know, at the time there were absolutely no incidences that were reported to the authorities, nothing that the newspapers had, simply nothing. It wasn't until years after the war that these stories started to emerge, and they emerged so effectively that most people simply take it as given history. And it has a tremendous impact on the ability of people to oppose America's wars, because, you know, the immediate mantra that gets raised is, well, we don't want to do what they did back during Vietnam. You don't want to oppose American soldiers. So once American soldiers are on the ground, and this is what happened in the Iraq War, as soon as American soldiers were on the ground, a good deal of the anti-war movement against that simply disintegrated, because, you know, they were afraid of being accused of being anti-soldier. I mean, the whole this is kind of the the dynamic, I think, the struggle that continues with every screening of the film. And as the film continues to, one of the things I'm surprised about how popular the film is in that context still. I mean, it's on Netflix, and Netflix still promotes it as one of their top documentaries, which I'm tremendously grateful for. And you know, it's still, unfortunately, is one of the only ways that people can find out this history, this reality of what happened during the Vietnam War.
Let's continue on with the phone lines. Hey, Ron, you're on the air.
Okay. Thanks, Alan, for the show. I wanted to bring your guest's attention that there was a guy here in Madison, Steve Runs, who headed up and worked with the newspaper Highway 13, which was an anti-war military publication. And I just wanted to bring that to your guest's attention. He spent years editing that paper and agitating against the war. And I just wanted to make sure your guests knew about Highway 13. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. One thing that you can hopefully check and make sure Highway 13 is part of, right there in Madison, I don't remember the name of the archive exactly, but there's an archive of GI anti-war papers in the Wisconsin Historical Society that was put together by, I can't remember his name again, recently. And he's got over 400 papers archived. Check out and make sure that paper is in there, because that's important. Thank you.
Yeah, the Social Action Collection at the Historical Society has done an amazing job over the years in collecting all sorts of ephemera from the period, anti-war posters, short-lived zines, underground papers, and so on. It's quite remarkable.
This one is particularly called the GI Press Collection. That's what to look for.
Okay. I want to, you know, we're running short of time already. There's so much to talk about. But I want to talk about the third phase of the period 1970-73, the shift toward increasing resistance and the increasingly open refusal to fight in Vietnam and the open rebellion in the ranks. Dave Zeiger, talk about the impact of the anti-war movement within the military, its important role, arguably key, in the shift toward what became known as Vietnamization, what Vietnamization was actually about versus what we were told or what many of us had learned.
Yes. And again, this is a really critical part of the actual history of that war. By 1970, the resistance inside the military had reached a point as one colonel who had done a study of this, a man named Colonel Heinel, as he wrote, that the army in particular was on a stage of near mutiny throughout the entire army. The ground troops, that the level of entire companies refusing to go out and fight was stunning. And the other part of it that was really the thing that I think that the military set them way back on their heels was something called fragging, which was a practice that GIs, if a sergeant or a captain was too gung-ho and kept wanting them to go out and fight, One night, a hand grenade, what's called a frag grenade, which is an anti, specifically designed to kill people by shooting tiny pellets into their body, would be rolled under the tent, and these guys would be killed. And the army itself documented 200 cases of fragging, of commanding officers being killed by their own troops. This is unprecedented. This had never happened before. And this type of resistance did reach a level where the army decided they had to pull the ground troops out of Vietnam, which they did. And by 1972, the army was no longer sending new troops to Vietnam. But what then happened was that both the war and the anti-war movement shifted much more towards the Air Force and the Navy, because what happened was that first under Johnson, but mainly under Nixon, the ground war was replaced by a bombing campaign that I think literally was, I think, the only country that so far has topped what the United States did in Vietnam, or at least come close to it, is Israel and Gaza today. I mean, the United States went on a bombing campaign against North Vietnam that was way more than dropping multiple atomic weapons on the country. They pretty much sought to bomb North Vietnam into submission. And in that context, once again, there were many cases of sailors refusing to board their ships. There was a massive campaign in San Francisco, a petition drive demanding that the Navy not send one of their main carriers to Vietnam. The Air Force in particular was experiencing, we have in our film a fascinating story that I didn't know about before, but of the group of Air Force guys who had been trained in Vietnamese, and their job was to listen in on and interpret Vietnamese radio communication during bombing raids, and they refused to participate in one of the most horrendous bombing raids that the United States put on. So, again, you know, wherever the United States was using American soldiers, Of whichever branch they were in, the anti-war movement exploded.
608-256-2001, if you have a quick question. We're getting short of time, but I can take another caller, hopefully. Talk about how the film lays out a counter-narrative. You've touched on this already, but I want to get into this a little more deeply. The film lays out a counter-narrative to some of the key mythologies popularized by the right in regard to the outcome of the war. You know, there's this old canard, really, that the U.S. could have won in Vietnam if it hadn't been for the liberal politicians who tied one arm behind the back of the military command that could have taken the country to victory. That in reality, the government found its military options limited by the unprecedented number of soldiers who broke ranks to join the anti-war movement. And that's really a different
take on that whole war. And of course, it segues into the reconstruction or the abandonment of the actual story, and in its place, a whole lot of mythologies, which again, we've touched on in some ways.
Yeah, first of all, the hands tied behind their back. The thing about, for me, that the story of the GI movement is one of the most, is the most inspiring movement in many ways from that time, because it showed the potential in a way that I don't think much else has shown, for the people to go up against the American Empire and be successful in that way. And it also showed the basic humanity of the majority of American people, including those who are tasked with the job of carrying out an American aggression overseas. And that's one thing. And then the second thing is, in terms of the mythology, there was, you know, the term that was popularized was the Vietnam Syndrome. And this was popularized particularly by Ronald Reagan when he was governor of California, and then when he was president. The Vietnam Syndrome was a syndrome where Americans would not accept the United States sending troops overseas to fight in a war. And a big part of how that syndrome, as they described it, was countered by the right wing and by the American government, and by Hollywood, by the way, in a very big way, was to create this myth that it was the fault of the students, the privileged middle-class white students who, you know, prevented the soldiers from being able to fight the war, who spat on them, and who were, you know, kind of because of all their anti-Americanism. And this myth, by the way, you know, the first time the United States sent troops overseas in a big way was in 1990, the first Gulf War. And it was in the buildup to that war that these stories, this mythology of anti-war activists spitting on GIs really, you know, became a major phenomenon in the media, and it had a very direct result. It was, you know, a very massive anti-war movement that had built up against the United States sending troops disintegrated as soon as the troops were on the ground, and it was because people believed that mythology. It was so powerful that it became so much part of the American whatever narrative that it had a very big impact. So this is not, we're not just talking about history here. We're talking about the impact that history has on the present day, and I think that's what makes this story, you know, continue to be fresh, continue to be alive, and continue to be very important.
I'm gonna ease in, squeeze in one more caller that's been waiting patiently. Carmen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, just some. Is it? A great program, very educational, and remembering. And anyway, I'll say it. That's enough about that, but thank you. The reason I'm calling is I have a brother-in-law who was a two-tour Vietnam veteran. He was a door gunner on helicopter. And he said he experienced disdain and when he returned home. And, you know, I suppose it's individual, and feeling that from one person is enough, you know. And even now, when I talk to veterans who've been in Iraq, they're, you can tell they're just kind of, their heart is guarded because not everyone agreed with what they were sent to do, and they didn't agree with it. But in any case, my brother-in-law experienced, you know, he experienced prejudice from people. And actually, that was, he couldn't reintegrate after the first coming home, and that's what he signed up to go back. I just wanted to say that.
Thank you, Carmen.
Yeah, thank you very much, Carmen. I, you know, one thing that's interesting, a couple things. One, you know, memory changes and gets shaped over time. And you know, we've gone through decades of being told, you know, about all this hostility. I'm not saying that there wasn't hostility, on, you know, sometimes individually or whatever. But the interesting thing is you have to look at this in the context of the times. And I remember one story that I read about a guy saying, yeah, when I came home, I was, you know, I couldn't tell anyone, you know, that I supported the war. And he says that, you know, since he came home, he started college, and he went to college at Berkeley. And the interesting thing to me is, you know, unfortunately, if you supported the war at Berkeley, I don't care who you were, you were going to get a lot of pushback. And I'm not, you know, trying to you know, denigrate, you know, anyone's view of things, but the war was being debated hotly throughout society, and yeah, there were a lot of emotions about that, and a lot of that, you know, again, I mean, I think, you know, for a lot of people, that in their mind, that got turned into, well, I just got, you know, denigrated because I was a GI or because, you know, all of that. And in particular, by the way, you know, again, this got turned into spitting. Spitting became kind of the imagery that really got promoted. And I've had situations where people have come to me and said, yeah, well, I was spat on. And I've talked to them. And as you talk, you know, the guy realized, well, okay, well, maybe I wasn't spat on, but, you know, they didn't like me, you know. And you know, unfortunately, this was a very, very contentious time for everyone, you know. And people, you know, were put in a position, I think rightly so, where they had to kind of take a stand one way or the other. And certainly you're going to get pushed back. I can tell you all kinds of stories about being attacked for my anti-war views. You know, it was very much a contentious time.
Dave Zeiger, we're running very short of time, but I wanted to, one final question we could squeeze in. We won't have time to go into it in depth. But that is the lessons learned by the war makers. That is the turn away from the draft and the promotion of the all-volunteer army.
Yeah, I mean, interestingly, at the same time that the military and government were denying that there was any kind of opposition to the war inside the military, they made dramatic changes in order to try to stifle that from happening again. All the way from, as you mentioned, eliminating the draft to eliminating, you know, they like petty harassment type of things that, excuse me, it just, you know, made things more difficult. For example, you know, I made a film about Iraq veterans against the war called This Is Where We Take Our Stand. It was about their activities that kind of mirrored and took inspiration from Vietnam veterans against the war. And it was really interesting, the stories I heard from them about the military in Iraq. For example, you know, there's no, you know, KP was, you know, it's just, I don't even remember what the initials stand for, but it was basically, you know, the GIs police had to do the cleaning up and all this kind of stuff on base. You know, the military brought in contractors to do all of that. In I was told that in Iraq, in the green zone in Iraq, you know, you could get any kind of fast food you wanted from, you know, they had McDonald's and all of them in there. I mean, that kind of stuff was unheard of during the Vietnam War. And in fact, one guy told me the biggest problem the military had in Iraq was obesity, because the food was so good. The other thing they did was that they learned that if they, you know, keep people together in their same unit during the entire war, that they would have a better chance of people at least supporting each other to the point where they're not going to go up against the war. Whereas in Vietnam, people were kind of circulated in and out individually. So they wanted to create this kind of esprit de corps. So anyway.
Dave Zeiger, we're going to have to cut it there. We're right down to the wire. I hope to have you back on. I'm on a plug. It's Wednesday, April 10th at 7 o'clock.
Sir, No Sir is being shown at the Historical Society on the Library Mall, the UW campus, and Dave Zeiger will be here in person with that film. So that's Wednesday, April 10th at 7 p.m. Zeiger, again, I want to thank you. I want to thank Jade, our producer, per usual, and Jack, per usual, the engineer. And I want to thank you, our listeners, our callers. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff.
While you walking off with all the gold, the bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never.
You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison.
With information that would never be reported, disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it live and direct. We come and never pre-recorded with information that would never be reported, disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. The White House says President Biden has told Israel's prime minister that strikes on aid workers in Gaza are unacceptable. It's the first phone call between the two leaders since Israel killed seven World Central Kitchen staff on Monday. The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken gave the details at a news conference.
The president emphasized that the strikes on humanitarian workers and the overall humanitarian situation are unacceptable. He made clear the need for Israel to announce a series of specific, concrete, and measurable steps to address civilian harm, humanitarian suffering, and the safety of aid workers.